Chapter 2. For several years now, Stephen Maturin had been perfectly aware that a life at sea, above all in a man of war, was not the waterborne picnic sometimes imagined by those living far inland. But he'd never supposed that anything could be quite so arduous as this existence between the two, neither floating free nor firmly ashore, with what conveniences the land might provide. The squadron, necessarily gathered together in a hurry and necessarily short-handed, had to be thoroughly reorganised. Above all, the unhappy Pomone. A ship always suffered from a trial for sodomy, and although her people hadn't been in her for anything like an ordinary commission, it was long enough for them to feel their position acutely, to resent the calls they heard ashore, or the smiles and meaning silence when a group of them walked into a bar. After all, one of their officers had been dismissed from the service in the most ignominious fashion possible and towed ashore on a grating in the view of countless spectators, and some of the discredit clung to his former shipmates. This corporate shame had a thoroughly bad effect on discipline, which had never been the Pomone's strongest point. And a new captain, with a second lieutenant who knew nobody aboard, was unlikely to remedy this state of affairs in the near future. She did have a good boatswain, however, and the gunner, though discouraged, was willing and knowledgeable. He and Captain Pumfret were suitably shocked when the Commodore invited them to accompany Surprise well out into the strait off Algeciras so that both ships might exercise the great guns firing at towed targets. The Pomones brought their ship out creditably, and they were reasonably brisk at the dumb show of running the 18-pounders in and out, but some of the gun crews were hesitant about firing them. Only three or four in the starboard battery had much notion of anything but point-blank aim or of judging the role. The first and second captains were competent upon the whole, but the midshipmen in charge of the divisions left much to be desired, and some of the ordinary hands belonging to the gun might never have seen an 18-pounder fired in earnest before. The fury of the recoil shocked them extremely, and after the first wavering, ragged broadside, several had to be led or carried below, hurt by iron-taut tackles and breechings, or even by the angles of the carriage itself. The marines, who took their places, did at least stand clear, but on the whole it was a most lamentable exhibition, and the Surprises had no compunction in making it even more obviously ludicrous by destroying, utterly destroying, the hitherto unscathed target with three broadsides in 5 minutes and 10 seconds. "Captain Pumfret," said Jack before he left the ship, "I can foresee a very great deal of great gun exercise, morning and afternoon, as well as at quarters. The team must know their pieces through and through so that they never have to think, as I'm sure you're very well aware." "Yes, sir," said Pumfret, trying to master his distress. "The only thing I can advance is that we're cruelly short-handed and the people haven't been together long." "You have enough right seamen to man your pinnace and launch?" "Yes, sir." "Then let your first lieutenant and the second, when he joins, I know the Admiral means to let you have an excellent young man, take them out in the middle watch and lie off Cape Spartel till dawn. If they do not press a score of hands out of the passing merchantmen who've not yet heard the news, I shall be amazed. But above all, keep your people hard at it, the young gentlemen especially. Idle young dogs sauntering about with their hands in their pockets. Hard at it. Yet, don't blackguard them. Praise if ever you can. You'll find it answer wonderfully. Next week you may fire live. Nothing pleases them more once they're used to the din." Returning to harbour, Jack visited the other ships and vessels of his squadron, requiring each to beat to quarters and at least to cast loose their guns. The exactness of the coiled muzzle-lashing made fast to the eye-bolt above the port lid, the seizing of the mid-breeching to the pommelion, the neat arrangement of the spange, handspike, powder-horn, priming wire, bed, coin, train-tackle, shot, and all the rest, told a knowing eye a great deal about the gun crew, and even more about the midshipmen of the subdivision. The Dover, Still actively reconverting herself was in rather a sad way, but not very discreditably so. The others would do at a push, and the little Briseis, one of that numerous class called coffin brigs, from their tendency to turn over and sink, was positively brilliant. He told her captain so, and the hands within earshot visibly swelled with satisfaction. Back to Surprise, and her great cabin. Familiar, elegant, but in spite of its conventional name, not really spacious enough for all the administrative work he had to do. There were no more than 6 ships or vessels in the squadron, but their books and papers already overflowed the Commodore's desk. Not much more than 1,000 men were concerned, but all those of real importance in the running of the squadron had to be entered on separate slips, together with what comments he had so far been able to make on their abilities. And to house these slips, he'd called upon his joiner to make temporary tray-like wings to his desk, so that eventually he should have all the elements at his disposal laid out to be rearranged according to the tasks the squadron might be called to undertake. In these quite exceptional circumstances, with no settled ships, companies apart from those in Surprise, and to some extent Briseis, he would have an equally exceptional free hand. But Jack Aubrey was a neat creature by temperament and rigorous training, and he'd set no more than 1 foot in the cabin before he saw that order was confounded, that some criminal hand had merged at least 3 compliments into 1 unmeaning heap, and that this same hand had spread out several manuscript sheets of music, the score of a Pavane in C minor. "Oh, I do beg your pardon, Jack," said Stephen, walking quickly in from the quarter gallery. "I had a sudden thought to be set down, but I trust I've not disturbed anything at all." "Not in the least," said Jack. "And Stephen, I believe I've solved your problem. I believe I have found you a loblolly boy you will thoroughly approve of." Stephen, concerned though he was with his music, only 2 bars yet to write, but the magical sound already fading from his inner ear, and filled though he was with a conviction that Jack's mild, not in the least, concealed an intense irritation, made no reply other than a questioning look. He owed his survival as an intelligence agent to an acute ear for falsity, and Jack's last words were certainly quite untrue. "Yes," Jack went on, "together with a draft of hands turned over to the squadron out of Leviathan, refitting, Maggie Cheel and Paul Skeeping have come aboard, and Paul was trained at Haslar. She's up to anything in the way of blood and horrors." "You're speaking of women, brother? You, who have always abominated so much as the smell of a skirt aboard ship? The invariable cause of trouble, quarrelling, ill luck, wholly out of place in any ship, above all in a man of war? I've never seen a woman aboard a man of war." "Have you not, my poor Stephen? Did you never see them helping with the guns and passing shot in Bologna?" "Never in life. Am I not always shot up in the cockpit during an action?" "Very true. But if Jill Travers, for example, the sailmaker's wife who helped serve Number 8, had been wounded, you would have seen her. But seriously, Jack, are you obliged to take these women aboard? You who have always inveighed against the creatures?" "These are not creatures, in the sense of whore ladies or Portsmouth trollops. Oh, no. They're usually middle-aged or more, often the wife or widow of a petty or even of a warrant officer. 1 or 2 may have run away, like the girl in the ballad wearing trousers to be with her Jack when he sailed. But most have used the sea these 10 or 20 years, and they look like seamen, only with a skirt and maybe shawl. And yet I've never seen one, apart from the odd gunner's wife who looks after the very little fellows. And apart, of course, from that poor unhappy Mrs. Horner on Juan Fernandez. To be sure, they do keep out of the way. They don't belong to any watch, of course, and they don't appear at quarters, no, nor anywhere else except when we rig church." At any other time he would have added that, for all his botanising and stuffing curious birds, Stephen was a singularly unobservant cove. He hadn't even noticed the brilliant flintlocks that now, by grace of Lord Keith, adorn Surprise's guns, doing away with those potential misfires when the linstock wavered over the touch hole or was doused by flying spray. misfires that might make those few seconds' difference between defeat and victory. Yet they blazed with all the splendour of Guinea gold, the pride of the crews, who surreptitiously breathed upon them, wiping off the mist with a silk handkerchief. "A loblolly girl, for our love? I wonder at it, Jack." "Come, come, Stephen. You say a loblolly boy for an ancient of 60 or even more. It's only a figure of speech, a naval figure of speech. And speaking of figures, Palsy's very like a round shot. She's a kind, cheerful, conscientious soul, but she's not likely to stir the amorous propensities of the thick berth. Besides, she's perfectly used to seamen and would instantly put them down. Will you at least have a word with her? I said I should mention her name. We were shipmates once, and I can answer for her being kind. No blaggarding, no bawling out orders, not topping at the ship's corporal. Kind, honest, sober, and very tender with the wounded." "Of course I'd see her, brother. A kind, honest, and sober nurse is a rare and valuable creature, God knows." Jack rang the bell, and to the answering Killick he said, "Tell Polskeeping the doctor will see her directly." Polskeeping had been at sea off and on for 20 years, sometimes under harsh and tyrannical officers. But for her, directly still allowed latitude enough for putting on a clean apron, changing her cap and finding her character. Thus equipped, she hurried to the cabin door, knocked and walked in, a little out of breath and obviously nervous. She bobbed to the officers, holding her character to her bosom. "Sit down, Paul," said Captain Aubrey, waving to a chair. "This is Dr. Maturin, who'd like to speak to you." She thanked him and sat bolt upright, the envelope of her character held like a shield. "Mrs. Skeeping," said Stephen, "I am without a sick berth attendant, a loblolly boy, and the captain tells me that you might like the post." "That was very kind in his honour," she said, bowing to Jack, "which I should be happy to be your sick berth attendant, sir." "May I ask about your experience and professional qualifications? The captain has already told me that you're kind, conscientious, and tender to the wounded, and indeed one can hardly ask more. But what of amputation, lithotomy, the use of the trephine?" "Bless you, sir, my father, God rest his soul," crossing herself, "was a butcher and horse knacker in the wholesale line down Deptford way, and my brothers and me used to play at surgeons in the jointing house. Then when I was at Haslar, they put me almost straight away into the theatre. So do you see, sir, I'm hardly what could be called squeamish. But may I show you my character, sir? The surgeon of my last ship, a very learned gentleman, tells what I can do better than ever I could manage." She passed the somewhat aged cover, and begging Jack's pardon, Stephen broke the seal. The elegant Latin testimonial to Mrs. Skeeping's worth, capabilities and exceptional sobriety was written in a remarkably familiar hand, but one to which he couldn't give a name until he turned the page and saw the signature of Kevin Teven, an Ulster Catholic from Cavan, a friend of his student days, and yet another Irishman who saw the Napoleonic tyranny as a far greater and more immediate evil than the English government of Ireland. "Well," he said, patting the letter affectionately, "anyone so highly spoken of by Mr. Teven would certainly answer for me. And since I do not yet have an assistant surgeon, he will be coming aboard this afternoon, I will show you the sick berth myself, if the captain will excuse us." "There," he went on at last, having displayed the neat arrangements of the surprise, "that deals with the ventilation system. No ship of the line can show a better. Now, pray tell me how Mr. Teven was when last you saw him." "He was brimming full of joy, sir. A cousin with a practice in some grand part of London and with too many patients offered him a partnership, and he left Mahon that very evening in Northumberland, going home to pay off and lay up. For that was when we thought it was all over, the pity and the woe. That bony." "The pity and woe indeed," said Stephen. "But with the blessing we shall soon settle his account." And running his eye over the neat shelves of the forward medicine chest, he said, "We are short of blue ointment. Do you understand the making of blue ointment, Mrs. Skeeping?"
"Oh, dear me, yes, sir. Many's the great jar I've ground in my time."
Then, pray, reach me down the little keg of hog's lard, the jar of mutton suet and the quicksilver. There are two mortars with their pestles just below the Kolkata vitriol. When they'd ground away companionably at their ointment for perhaps half a glass, Stephen said, Mrs. Skeeping, in my sea time I've seen few, very few women at all, although I'm told they're not, in fact, so very rare. Will you tell me how they come to be aboard and why they stay in a place so often damp and always so bare of comfort? Why, sir, in the first place, a good many warrant officers, like the gunner, of course, take their wives to sea, and some captains allow the good petty officers to do the same. Then there are wives that take a relation along. My particular friend Maggie Cheel is the boatswain's wife's sister. And some just take passage with the captain's or first lieutenant's leave. And there are a few in very hard times by land that dress as men and aren't found out until very late when no notice is taken. They speak gruff, they're good seamen, and it's not much odds after 40. And as for staying aboard, it's not a comfortable life, to be sure, except in a first or second rate that doesn't wear a flag. But there is company, and you're sure of food. And then men, upon the whole, are kinder than women. You get used to it all, and the order and regularities are comfort in itself. For my part, it was as simple as kiss your hand. At Haslar, I was put to look after an officer, a post-captain that had lost a foot. There had been a secondary resection, and the dressing was very delicate. His wife, Mrs. Wilson, and the children came to see him every day, and when the wound was healed and he posted to a 74 in Jamaica, she asked me to go with them looking after the little ones. It was a long, slow voyage with no foul weather, and everybody enjoyed it, most of all the children. But they'd not been there a month before they were all dead of the yellow jack. Luckily for me, the officer who took over Captain Wilson's ship brought a great many youngsters aboard, more than the gunner's wife could deal with. So we, having made friends on the way over, she asked me to give her a hand, and so it went. Relations in ships. I had a sister married to the sailmaker's mate in Ajax. Friends in ships, with a spell or two in naval hospitals. But here I am, lovely boy in surprise, I hope, sir, if I give satisfaction. Certainly you are. Particularly as I learn from Mr. Teven that you do not play the physician, puzzle the patients with long words, or criticise the doctor's orders. Mrs. Skeeping thanked him very kindly. But having taken her leave, she paused at the door, and blushing, she said, Sir, might I beg you to call me just Poll, as the captain does, and Killick and all the others I've been shipmates with? Otherwise they'd think I was topping at the knob, and that they'll not abide. No, not if it's ever so. By all means, Poll, my dear, said Stephen. He read a couple of pages on leeches and their surprising variety in the transactions, and then, judging his time, summoned their common steward and said, Preserve Killick, I am going to fetch Dr. Jacob, my assistant surgeon, who, as you know, is to mess in the gun room. Which the captain told me, said Killick, with a satisfied smile. So did Mr. Harding. And I should like you to find him a stout boy to be his servant, and to bring his sea chest down from Thompson's in their little two-wheeled cart. You will give the gunroom cook good warning, I'm sure. The introduction went as well and easily as Stephen could have wished. Harding, Summers, and Hewell were hospitable, civilised men, and the quiet, unpretentious Dr. Jacob, willing to please and to be pleased, succeeded in both. He was somewhat older than the lieutenants, which ensured a certain respect. His friendship with their much-esteemed doctor gave rise to more, and when Woodbine, the master, hurried in, he found the gunroom in a fine buzz of conversation. He excused his lateness to the president. That sudden gust took Elpenor the Greek over the side, and we've been fishing him out. A very strong and sudden gust indeed, northeast. How do you do, sir? This to Jacob. You're very welcome, I'm sure. A glass of wine with you, sir. With shore supplies at hand, it was a pleasant meal, with a steady flow of talk, much of it about the sea and its wonders, the enormous rays of the West Indies, albatrosses nesting on Desolation Island, one of the many Desolation Islands, and their tameness, St. Elmo's fire, the Northern Lights. Woodbine belonged to an older generation than the lieutenants. He'd travelled even more widely, and encouraged by the close attention of the medical man, he spoke at considerable length about some pools or natural resurgences of pitch in Mexico. Not to be compared to the pitch lake in Trinidad for size, but much more interesting. There's one where the tar comes bubbling up in the middle, so liquid you can take it with a ladle. And every now and then a white bone comes surging up in the great bubble. Such bones! People may prate about their Russian mammoths, but these creatures, or some of them, would make mammoths look like pug dogs. The gentleman that took me there, a natural philosopher, collects the most curious, and he showed me great curved tusks, oh, 3 fathoms long, and... Another of those curious, furious blasts came down from the face of the rock, ruffling the whole bay and healing the surprise so that all hands automatically reached for their glasses and the mess servants grasped the backs of the chairs. The master, an unusually truthful, scrupulous man, an elder of the congregation of Sethians in Shelmerston, checked himself and said, well, perhaps 10 foot to be on the safe side. And I tell you what, gentlemen, I've known this gust or warning foretell a 7-day blow out of the northeast 4 or even 5 times when my ship's been lying here. In that case, God help the poor fellows in Pomone's boats, said Summers. He spoke facetiously, but the master shook his head, asking, did you ever know a bad omen to be wrong, Mr. Summers? There did indeed follow a series of strong, steady winds, scarcely varying a point in direction from northeast day after day, nor in force from full to close-reefed topsails. And during all this time, Jack and David Adams, his clerk on and off these many years, but now styled his secretary and paid as such, for although on this occasion it had been agreed that Jack, with a small squadron soon to be split up for various duties, while he himself was to have such a particular mission, should not have a captain under him, he was certainly allowed a secretary. During all this time they rearranged the forces at hand and the recent drafts, the Commodore exercising them at gunnery whenever it was at all possible, and dining regularly with his captains. 2 of them he liked very well. Young Pomfret in acting command of Pomone, and Harris of Briseis, both excellent seamen, and both of his own mind entirely about the capital importance of rapid, accurate fire. Brawley and Cartwright of the corvettes Rainbow and Ganymede, though somewhat lacking in authority, were agreeable young men, but they were not fortunate in their offices, and neither ship was in first-rate order, which was a pity, since both were Bermuda-built, dry, swift, and weatherly. Ward of the Dover, on the other hand, was the kind of man Jack could not possibly like. Heavy, graceless, dark-faced, rude, domineering, and inefficient. He was said to be rich, and he was certainly mean. A very rare combination in a sailor, though Jack had met it before. A man generally disliked is hardly apt to lavish good food and wine on those who despise him, and Ward's dinners were execrable. The wind, which at times was strong enough to send small pebbles flying through the air on the upper reaches of the rock, didn't interrupt Stephen's habit of visiting the hospital every morning. He generally went there with Jacob, and on 2 separate occasions he had the pleasure of carrying out his particular operation of suprapubic cystotomy in the presence of the physician of the fleet and of Poll, who comforted the patient and passed the sutures. She told Jacob in private that it was the neatest, quickest job she'd ever seen. She'd never have believed it could have been done so quick, and with scarcely a groan. I shall light a candle for each of them against the infection. Yet, although the wind didn't interfere with his work, which included a very minute dissection with Jacob's help of the anomalous hand, It did away with his outdoor pleasure almost entirely. The migrant birds, always averse to crossing wide expanses of sea and wholly incapable of making headway against gales of this nature, were pinned down in Morocco. And in the sheltered hollows behind Cape Spartel, 20 booted eagles might be seen in a single bush. He turned, therefore, to an occupation that fell into neither category. And it having been turning in his mind for some time, particularly at night, he quickly finished the second part of his suite, a Forlan. Copied it fair that afternoon and showed it to Jack in the evening. Sitting there with the score tilted towards the lamp and what little light there was, with the small rain sweeping in swathes across the sea, his mouth now formed for whistling, but silent, now for a very deep humming where the cello came in, Jack came to the end of the saraband with its curiously reiterated melody. He gathered the sheets and reached for the Forlan. "It's terribly sad," he observed, almost to himself, words he wished unsaid with all his heart. "Do you know any happy music?" asked Stephen. "I do not." Embarrassment hung there in the great cabin for no more than a moment before it was dissipated first by a measured series of small explosions and then by Salmon, master's mate, bursting in as the ship, heeling before a fresh blast, shot him through the door. "Beg pardon, sir," he cried, "beg pardon. Ringle's come in. That was her, sir, saluting the flag." Divided between fury that the schooner could have come in unseen and unhailed and delight at her presence, Jack gave Salmon a cold glance. He saw that the young man was dripping to a most uncommon degree and called for his boat cloak. As soon as he was on deck, he saw why no lookout had reported a sail. Even with this short fetch, the unceasing wind had built up a wall of broken water against the towering mole, a wall made even more impenetrable at deck height by the fog-like rain and the disappearance of the sun's faint, faint ghost behind the rock. Furthermore, to shoot between the moles, Ringle had shown no more than a scrap of storm jib right in, which her people were now stowing in a seaman-like fashion. Her one-armed captain was already halfway up the frigate's side, extraordinarily nimble with his hook. He carried a packet of letters in his bosom. "Come on board, sir," he said, saluting as he reached the quarter-deck. "How in God's name did you get here so quick, William?" cried Jack, shaking his one hand. "I hadn't looked for you this week and more. Come below. Have a toss of brandy. You must be destroyed." "Why, sir, you wouldn't believe our run. This splendid breeze right after on our quarter, day after day. But, sir, before I say anything more than all's well at home, much love from all hands," here he put down his packet, "I must tell you we saw Pomone's boats being attacked by small craft under the lee of Spartel, where they were lying to after a cruel long pull. We soon dealt with the Moors and offered the boats a tow, but Pomone's first lieutenant said, 'No, we must carry straight on and tell the flag that there were half a dozen Sally Rovers in Laraish waiting for the East Indiaman lying to just down the coast. He said he could certainly look after the local Moors if they came back with the small arms we'd given them, and he bade us shove off instantly. There was not a moment to lose.'" "Very true," said Jack. "Mr. Harding, strike to gallant masts down on deck, take a warp out onto the mole, throw out the signal, squadron, prepare to unmoor. I'm going across to the flag in Mr. Reed's boat." It was not a long pull to the Royal Sovereign, but in spite of their hooded boat cloaks, both Jack and William Reed came up the side as wet as drowned rats. Waterlogged officers were by no means rare in the Royal Navy, however, and their appearance excited no comment. But when Jack, in a very few words, had outlined the position, the captain of the fleet whistled and said, "By God, I think you must see the Admiral." Jack repeated his statement to Lord Keith, who looked grave and asked, "What measures do you propose?" "My lord, I propose leading the squadron out directly, making for Laraish. If the corsairs are still there, I shall just make a show of force and stand on until I find the Indiaman, presumably still lying under the Sugarloaf. If I find them engaged, clearly I disengage them. If not, I escort them westward and as near north as they can lie, leaving Dover to see them home.
Make it so, Captain Aubrey.
Aye, aye, sir. My best compliments to Lady Keith, if you please. On his way back, the boat passed Dover and Pomone, both of which he hailed, directing them to make sail, to shape a course for Tangier, and to attend to his signals. It was not really night when he reached the Surprise, but the weather was so thick that he sent his orders by word of mouth to the rest of the squadron, adding that signals would now be made by lights and guns. It gave him the liveliest pleasure to see how naturally the frigate came to life. Battle lanterns fore and aft, the signal midshipman and his yeomen overhauling the flares, the blue lights and apparatus, the ease with which the warp moved the ship's 600 tons and all her people towards the mole, and the totally professional, even nonchalant manner in which, edging round its head with barely steerage way, they flashed out headsails, carried her clean through the gap and into the open sea, where she lay a-try waiting for the others to join her. This they did creditably enough on the whole, though their moorings had been ill-placed for this uncommon wind, while the mole itself and its overlapping neighbour in the course of construction were singularly awkward. But in the event they all came through, though Dover, setting a trifle too much sail at that unhandy turn, grazed the new stonework with enough force to wound her forward starboard main chains. Her captain's voice, cracked with fury, could be heard a great way downwind. Yet even so, he had enough right sailors, officers and ratings aboard to make sail and steer the course shown by the Commodore's signal, while the excellent boatswain and his mates made good the worst of the damage, so that the frigate, though disfigured, didn't disgrace herself as the squadron formed the line, heading for a point west of Tangier that no more than 8 knots to give the Dover time to reinforce the main shrouds before their southward turn for La Laiche. They'd scarcely cleared the straits, leaving the glow of Tangier on the larboard quarter before the rain stopped and the wind lessened, though it was still capable of a powerful gust from the same direction. "Mr. Woodbine," said Jack to the master, "I believe we may send up the topgallant mast and spread a little more canvas." This, with the help of a clearing sky over the main ocean, the light of a splendid moon and a more regular sea, was soon done, and the squadron, well in hand, at the proper cable's length apart, ran down the Moroccan coast under courses and full topsails, with an easier following sea and the wind on their larboard quarter. They were still in the order of their leaving, Ringle lying under Surprise's lee as became a tender. This was pure sailing, with a fine regular heave and lift, an urgency of the water along the side, and sea-harping in the taut sheets and windward shrouds, the moon and the stars making their even journey across the clearer sky from bow to quarter, pause and back again. At 8 bells in the first watch, the log was heaved, and a very small and sleepy boy reported, 12 knots and 1 fathom, sir, if you please." "Thank you, Mr. Wells," said Jack. "You may turn in now."
"Thank you very much, sir."
"Good night, sir," said the child, and staggered off to get 4 hours' sleep. Beautiful sailing. And it was with some reluctance that Jack, having rearranged his line by signal so that they sailed Surprise, Pomone, Dover, Ganymede, Rainbow, Briseis, left the deck. He had an overwhelming desire to read his letters again, thoroughly digesting every detail. The cabin had not yet been fully cleared for action, and Stephen was sitting there, with the light of an argand lamp focused by a concave mirror onto the dark purple of that terrible hand, now stretched out by clamps on a board. And he was making an extraordinarily exact drawing of a particular tendon, in spite of the frigate's motion. "What a sea-dog you'll become," said Jack. "I flatter myself that a whole pack of sea-dogs could not have improved upon the forward starboard aspect of this aponeurosis," said Stephen. "I do it by pressing the underneath of the table with my knees and the top of it with my elbows, so that we all, paper, object, table and draughtsman, move together with very little discontinuity. One substance, as it were. To be sure, a fairly regular motion of the vessel is required, and for regularity, this slow, even swing could hardly be better. Though the amplitude calls for such tension that I believe I shall now take a spell. They both returned to their heaps of letters. Small heaps, since William Reed had kept nagging at the writers about his tide, and since they'd had so little notice that many things of the first importance flew out of their heads. Clarissa Oakes wrote by far the best, least flustered account of the household and its return towards something like a normal existence, much helped by the unchanging ritual of the countryside, of Jack's estate and his plantations in particular, and by the children's steadily continuing education. Sophie's two hurried, tear-blotted pages did her heart more credit than her head, but it was clear that the company of Mrs. Oakes was a great relief to her. Though, of course, their neighbours, far and near, were very kind. She asked Jack's advice about the wording of her mother's epitaph. The stone was ready and the mason eager to begin. And she referred to the window tax. "Sophie and the children said their love," he said, when Stephen laid down the letter he was reading. "George tells me that the keeper showed him a set with young badgers in it." "That is kind of them," said Stephen. "And Bridget sends you hers, together with a long passage from Padine that I cannot make out entirely. He told it her in Irish, you see. They generally speak Irish together. But although she's perfectly fluent in the language, she has no notion at all of its orthography. So she writes it as it might sound spoken by an English person. In time I shall find out the meaning, I'm sure, by murmuring it aloud." He fell to his murmuring, and Jack to a closer study of Sophie's hurried, distracted words. Both were interrupted by the sound of seven bells in the middle watch. Jack tidied his papers, reached for his sextant, and stood up. "Is anything afoot?" asked Stephen. "I must look at the coast, take our latitude, and have a word with William. We should be quite near the height of Lalaish by now." On deck he found the sky clearer still, with the outline of the shore plain against it. Both wind and sea had been diminishing steadily, and if it had not been for his doubt about the solidity of Dover's mainmast, he would have increased sail some time ago. He glanced down the line, all present and correct, and to leeward, where the schooner was running goose-winged on a course exactly parallel with his, well within hail for a powerful voice. Jack had a powerful voice, strengthened by many, many years of practice. But for the moment he contented himself with looking at the logboard, with all its entries of course and speed, doing some mental arithmetic, and taking the exact double-checked height of Mizar, a star for which he had a particular affection. "Mr. Hewell," he asked the officer of the watch, "what do you make our position?"
"Just at seven bells, sir, I had a very good observation, and found 35 degrees 17 minutes and perhaps 12 seconds."
"Very good," said Jack with satisfaction. "Let's signal squadron diminish lights, reduce sail." Then, leaning over the rail, "Ringle."
"Sir?"
"Close to speak pennant." "William," said Jack in a conversational tone some minutes later, looking down at the young man who stood there smiling up, his steel hook gleaming in the foremast ratlins. "William, you've been in and out of Lalaish pretty often, I believe."
"Oh, a score of times at least, sir. There was a young person..."
"That's to say, quite frequently, sir."
"And are we near enough for you to recognise the shoreline?"
"Yes, sir." "Then be so good as to look into the harbour, and if you see more than two or three corsairs, big Zeebeck-rigged corsairs and galleys, stand half a mile offshore and send up three blue lights. If less, then red lights, and rejoin without the loss of a moment." "Aye, aye, sir. More than three, stand off half a mile, three blue lights, less than red lights, and rejoin without the loss of a moment." "Make it so, Mr. Reed. Mr. Hewell,
reduce sail in conformity with pennant. And directing his voice upwards, look afore there! Eight bells. All round surprise, the sentinels called all's well and prepared to go below, but without much conviction, they knowing the general situation and their captain's tone of voice. How right they were! As soon as the muffled thunder of the watch below hurrying up on deck had died away, Jack said loud and clear to Summers, the relieving officer, Mr. Summers, we may pipe to breakfast at two bells or earlier and then clear. It's not worth going below. Look out afore there! He swung over the rail to the larboard ratlins and ran up to the maintop. Good morning, Wilson, he said to the lookout, and stood gazing away eastward. Gazing. Gazing. Two bells. And almost at once three red lights appeared, spreading like crimson flowers, one after another, fading and drifting away fast downwind. Before the second had reached its full, Jack called down, pipe to breakfast. On the quarter-deck he gave orders to increase sail, to steer south by south-southwest, and to prepare for action. These, of course, were signals, but by word of mouth he sent to tell the cook to use a bucket of slush to get the galley stove right hot, right quick. Stephen, he said, walking into the cabin, I'm afraid we must disturb you. William has just let us know that La Raiche has no corsairs. Since the wind has been dropping this last watch and more, the likelihood is that the Indiamen will very soon leave their shelter under the lee of the Sugarloaf, sailing for home, and that the corsairs mean to cut them off. So we're pelting down to stop their capers. We shall be setting close reef to gallants presently, and quite soon we shall have to turn you out to clear for action. But at least there is this consolation. We shall have an uncovenanted pot of coffee. It's always far better for the people to have something in their belly before a fight, even if it's only hot burgoo. And since the fires are lit, we may as well profit by the situation.
It is our obvious duty, said Stephen with a pale smile.
In the earlier crises of his life, he had often, indeed generally, taken refuge in laudanum, or more recently in coca leaves. On this occasion he had entirely forsworn them, together with tobacco, and anything but the merest token of wine to avoid singularity. Yet he had always despised the stylite or even hair-shirt kind of asceticism, and he was still drinking the last of the pot with something not far from relish. Jack had left him 10 minutes earlier, when the thundering drum beat to quarters. He swallowed the remaining grouts, and hurried down to the orlop, where he found Paul and Harris, the ship's butcher. Seamen had already lashed chests together to form two operating tables, and Paul was making fast the covers of No. 8 sailcloth with a practised hand. She'd already laid out a selection of saws, catlings, clamps, tourniquets, leather-covered chains, dressings, splints, while Harris had lined up buckets, swabs and the usual boxes for limbs. To them, after a singularly long pause, entered Dr. Jacob, led by an irascible boy. Not a ship's boy, but a nominal captain's servant, entered as a first-class volunteer and looked after by the gunner until he should be rated midshipman and joined their berth. One of those useless little creatures who had been wished on Jack Aubrey and Gibraltar by former shipmates, men he could not refuse. Though the original hydrographical surprise had carried no learners, only thoroughly trained midshipmen capable of passing their examination for lieutenant in a year or two.
There, sir, said the first-class volunteer. It was as simple as I told you the first time. First left, second left, down the ladder, and second on your right. Your right!
Thank you, said Jacob. And to Stephen, oh, sir, I do beg you to forgive me. I'm no great seaman, as you know, and this great dark, wandering labyrinth confounded me, darkness visible. At one time I found myself by the seat of ease in the head, spray dashing upon me from the rising wave.
No doubt it'll become more familiar in time, said Stephen. What do you say to putting a true razor's edge on our implements?
Paul, my dear, there are two coarse and two very fine oil stones on the bottom shelf of the medicine chest. Each of the surgeons valued himself upon his skill in sharpening knives of all kinds, scalpels, gouges, almost everything indeed except saws which they left to the armourer,
and they ground away by the light of the powerful lamp. There was some degree of silent competition, avowed only by the slightly ostentatious manner in which each shaved his forearm with his finished blade, and his evident complacency when the skin was left perfectly bare. Stephen was uniformly successful with the scalpels, but he had to return the largest catling, a heavy, double-edged, sharp-pointed amputating knife, to the coarse stone again and again.
"Now, sir!" cried Harris, who could bear it no longer. "Let me show you!"
Stephen was not a particularly sweet-tempered man, above all at this moment when Jacob had scarcely a hair left to show. But Harris's professional authority was so evident that he let the heavy catling be taken. He let the stone be spat upon, the spittle smoothed with an even rapid drawing movement, heel to tip, then transferred to the fine stone, and finished with an emulsion of spit and oil.
"There, sir," said the butcher. "That's how we do it in Leadenhall Market, asking your pardon." "Well, damn you, Harris,"
said Stephen, having tried the superlative edge. "If ever I have to operate upon you, I shall do so with an instrument of your own preparing, and—" He was about to add something more likely to please, when all present raised their heads, listening intently, ignoring the sound of the hull in a fairly heavy sea, the whole complex voice of the ship. And after a few seconds, there it was again. Not thunder, but the sound of guns. On deck, Jack had not only the advantage of hearing more clearly, but of seeing, too. The squadron had been sailing close inshore, heading for a point beyond which there rose the modest hill called the Sugarloaf. At the first remote sound, he had thrown out the signal, "Make more sail." And when they came round the point at 12 or even 13 knots, they had the battle spread out full before them in the little leeward bay, rosy with a burning ship, and lit by innumerable flashes. The East India convoy, under sail, was being attacked by at least a score of Zevexian galleys, while small craft crammed with Moors waited to board any disabled merchantmen. The convoy, escorted only by a 16-gun brig sloop, had formed in something of a line, and it was protecting itself moderately well against the Zevex, powerfully armed though they were. But it was almost helpless against the galleys, which could race downwind of the line under sail, turn, take to their oars, and come up from leeward, raking the hindmost ships from right aft or on the quarter, where their guns, though comparatively small and few, could do terrible slaughter, firing from so low and near right along the deck, while the galley itself could not be touched by its victim's cannon. The rearmost Indiaman it was that lit the bay, an enemy shot having no doubt traversed her lightroom and powder magazine. But even without that, the moonlight, the clear sky, and the flashes made the position perfectly evident. Jack made the signal for independent engagement, emphasised it with two guns, and he launched the surprise at what seemed to be the commanding Zebek, the Corsair's leader. The Moors had no distinct line of battle, but this one wore some red and tawny pennants. They met, sailing with the wind on the beam, surprise on the starboard tack, the Moor on the larboard. When each was 5 points on the other's bow, Jack backed his foretopsail and called, "On the downward roll! Fire from forward as they bear!" All along the deck the gun crews crouched, motionless, the captain with the linstock in his hand glaring along the barrel. Officers and midshipmen exactly spaced. Some desultory musket fire, two or three well-directed round shot from the Zebek, the tingling sound of a gun hit full on the barrel, and immediately after the height of the wave, surprise fired a long, rippling broadside from 40 yards. The wind blew the smoke back, blinding them, and when it cleared they saw a most shocking wreckage, half the Zebek's ports beaten in, and her rudder shot away. They also heard Jack's roaring, "Look alive, look alive there, run them out!" His order to fill the topsail, and the cry, "Port your helm!" He took the surprise right under the Zebek's stern. The frigate stayed beautifully and ran up the enemy's side. The next, slower, even more deliberate broadside shattered the Moor entirely. Xebecs were fine, nimble, fast-sailing craft, but they were not strongly built, and she began to settle at once, her people crowding the deck and flinging everything that would float over the side. Jack saw the whole of the rest of the squadron engaged, and Ringle playing long bowls with a half-galley that was trying to get into position to rake an Indiaman. Even Dover had come up, in spite of having lost her main topmast, and the bay resounded with the bellowing of guns. But already the issue was decided. The convoy and its escort had mauled the corsairs quite seriously in the first phase, and the arrival of six brisk men-of-war made it absurd to stay. Those Xebecs that could spread their huge lateens on either side, in hare's ears, and raced away at close on 15 knots southward home to Sally, where with their slight draught they could lie safely inside the bar, while the uninjured galleys pulled straight into the wind's eye where no sailing ship could follow them. There were some stragglers, wounded Xebecs and such, but there was no point in chasing them. They were useless as prizes, and in any case there were more important things to do, such as succouring the ship on fire. The blaze having been mastered by sunrise, and the combined boatswains and carpenters of the convoy having set about re-rigging and repairing the ship, the Commodore and senior captains of the Indiamen waited on Jack to express their acknowledgements and to hope that his squadron hadn't suffered very grievous loss. "Two of our men were killed, I regret to say, in the very first exchange, when a gun was struck on the muzzle. Otherwise there were only musket ball and splinter wounds. Perhaps a score of hands in the sick bay. The rest of the squadron are in much the same case. But I'm afraid your losses must have been more considerable." "Nothing to touch there, sir, I do assure you. The three galleys that Pomone destroyed or cut in two would have manned a heavy frigate." Killick uttered a theatrical cough. And when Jack turned, he said, "Beg pardon, sir, which coffee's up and a little relish?" The relish consisted of Gibraltar crabs, lobsters, crayfish, prawns and shrimps. And the captains ate them with the keen appetite of those who had had a long, wearisome and ultimately extremely dangerous voyage on short commons from Cape Town on. They looked upon their host with more than usual benevolence, and with the intention of making an obliging remark, one of them said he was very glad that Commodore Aubrey should have suffered so little in what might have been a most bloody engagement. "It is true, as the gentleman observes, that we lost few men," replied Jack, "but then we had very few men to lose. The squadron is sadly short of hands, Pomone above all. And I'll tell you frankly that before I knew of your plight, I'd intended that her boat should have visited you in the hope of some right seaman. And for my own part, I should be thankful for two or three upper yard hands, and above all for a steady, reliable master's mate. When you sailed, none of you could have known that the war had broken out again, so I dare say there are 20 or 30 men in the convoy who would like to enter voluntarily and take the bounty." In the short pause that followed, the captains looked at their chief with a studied want of expression. But he, knowing them well, gathered the sense of the company. Everyone present knew that Jack could press if he chose. Everyone knew how much they owed him. And he replied, "I'm sure you're right, sir. And I'm sure that none of us would be so wanting in his duty as to make the slightest difficulty. Word will be passed in all ships belonging to the convoy, together with a promise that any man joining you will have his pay docket to the present date countersigned by me. As for your 20 or 30 active young upper yard men, I shall certainly send you 4 of my own. But where master's mates are concerned, we're all very poor indeed. Guinea pigs by the dozen, but nothing that would answer for you, sir. On the other hand, I could offer you a bright, well-qualified, gentlemanly purser as a volunteer, sir," he added, seeing the doubt in the Commodore's eye, a doubt caused not only by the strangeness of the offer, but even more so, for the offer in itself was by no means unwelcome, though inexplicable, by the countless formalities surrounding the appointment of a purser in a ship of the Royal Navy. the sureties, the guarantees, the verbiage, the paperwork. Purely as a volunteer, just for a few months or so, if so desired, or at least until his domestic affairs are settled. There's a question of children born when he was on a 3-year China voyage. The first he heard of it was at the Cape on the way back, and he doesn't like to go home until the lawyers have dealt with it all. He cannot face going into his own house with the little bastards running about in it, if I may so express myself without offence. He's used to the Navy, sir. Was captain's clerk in Hebe, then purser in Dryad and Hermione, before joining the company where his brother has a China ship. For the hydrographical voyage, Jack had intended to act as his own purser. Yet, even by Funchal, he had found it a very wearisome task indeed, and now that he had this present command, some relief was essential. 3 times he'd meant to speak of it aboard the Royal Sovereign, and 3 times he'd lost the opportunity. "Do you guarantee your man?" he asked. "Without the least reserve, sir." "Then I should be happy to see him, and his fellows, of course. Now, for my part, I don't believe for a moment that those villains are going to lie in Sally, wringing their hands and lamenting their loss. So, in case they come out again when the squadron's gone, I shall send Dover to strengthen your escort. They'll not face your artillery again, backed up with that of a 32-gun frigate. And there's always the possibility of French privateers or even men-of-war in the Channel."
"Very good. Hear him, hear him!" cried the captains, beating on the table.
When they'd buried their dead, an expeditious matter at such a time, and repaired the worst of their damage, the convoy and squadron parted on the best of terms, the Indiamen and their escorts steering northwest, and the squadron beating up tack upon tack for Gibraltar. Stephen and Jacob had some very seriously injured patients, as well as the routine strains, common fractures, contusions and powder burns. And it was now that Dr. Maturin came to appreciate the full value of good female nursing. Both Polskeeping and Mrs. Cheel had that devotion peculiar perhaps to their sex, and a lightness of hand, a dexterity where dressings were concerned that he'd not seen equalled outside a religious order. He was busy, but not desperately so, as he had been after some much bloodier fights, and he was quite able to accept Jack's invitation to dine with several of the captains and other officers. He was placed between Hugh Pumfret and Mr. Woodbine, the master, an old acquaintance who was eagerly engaged in an argument with Captain Cartwright of Ganymede about lunar observations, an argument that had started before dinner and that didn't interest Stephen in the least. Captain Pumfret, though obviously unwell and in very low spirits, was a civilised man, and he provided a proper amount of conversation, yet their end of the table could hardly have been described as outstandingly cheerful or amusing. And it didn't surprise Stephen when, as the party broke up, Pumfret asked in a low voice whether he might beg for a consultation, a medical or quasi-medical consultation at any time that suited Dr. Maturin. "Certainly you may," said Stephen, who very much liked what he'd seen of the young man and who knew the limits of Pomone's surgeon. "But only with the concurrence of Mr. Glover." "Mr. Glover is no doubt a very clever doctor," said Pumfret, "but unhappily we are barely on speaking terms, and this is a wholly personal, confidential matter. Let's take a turn upon deck." There, under the open sky, with the ship close-hauled on the larboard tack, he explained the rudiments of medical etiquette. "I quite take your point," said Pumfret, "but this is more what might be called a moral or spiritual rather than a physical matter, not wholly unlike the distinction between right and wrong."
"If you would be a little more specific, I might perhaps tell you whether I could probably be of any use."
"My trouble is this. Pomone, under my orders, beat 1 Moorish galley to pieces by gunfire and deliberately rowed down 2 others in the melee, cutting them in half so that they sank within the minute. And I perpetually see those scores of men, Christian slaves chained to their oars, looking up in horror, looking up perhaps for mercy, and I sailed on to destroy another. Is it right? Can it be right? I cannot sleep for those faces gazing, straining up. Have I mistaken my profession? On the face of it, said Stephen, I do not think you have. I feel extremely for your very great distress, but no. I should have to summon more powers than I can call upon at present to justify a war, even a war against a dictatorial system, an open denial of freedom, and I shall only say that I feel it must be fought. And since it has to be fought, it is better that it should be fought at least on one side, with what humanity war does allow, and by officers of your kind. I shall play the doctor so far as to send you a box of pills that will give you 2 nights' heavy sleep. If, having slept, you wish to hear my reasons, I hope I shall have them fairly well arranged, and after that you must be your own physician.